Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Well, the second, and as it transpired, final US presidential debate of the 2020 campaign ended, as many viewers and commentators say they had hoped it would begin with something approaching an actual debate. But who won? And with 47 million Americans having already voted, and the vast majority of those who haven't saying they've already made their mind up, will this last debate have changed anything? I'm Graham Stewart, and in this Critic magazine podcast, I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by The Critic's U.S. editor, Oliver Wiseman, and from Arizona by Chris Buskirk, editor of American Greatness. To assess whether Thursday's debate was entertainment or illumination, Chris Buskirk, which was it?
It was a bit of both. The first debate, of course, was pure entertainment, in my estimation. At least I was entertained. Maybe not everybody else was. Last night was a bit different. It was it gave everybody what they said they wanted. What I've read so far is people seem to have appreciated the change in style and in tone. I've been asked about, it's early here still while we're recording, but I've been asked about it all night, is who won, right? And the aesthetic of it was interesting because Trump was not very Trumpian last night, right? He went everybody expected him to zig and he zagged, and he had a good command of the facts. He was firm, but polite. Nobody expects from Donald Trump, and he did quite well, and he was very good on the substance, which was again, this is what everybody says they want, so we'll see how that actually plays out in practice.
We'll come to the substance in a moment, but the fact it was a debate, and the fact that, as you say, Chris, Trump's style was much more courteous than has been his forte. Was that, do you think, a strategic decision in the Trump camp, or was it a consequence of, frankly, a much higher quality of moderation? I mean, everyone is saying, and I would agree with it, that Kristen Welker was perhaps the biggest winner of the night. Very good moderation. She allowed a debate to flow. She allowed points to be picked up on and refuted or argued with. Is that what led to a better debate, or actually, do you think Team Trump said, Donald, you need to cool it and calm it?
Yeah, I mean, with taking nothing away from Christine Welker, who I thought did a pretty good job last night, and it's really always, you're in a sort of a no-win position when you're the moderator because everybody's got their sort of partisan axe to grind and they'll nitpick you apart. But she did, I thought, just a, totally fine job. It wasn't about her. It really was about the candidates that up there. There's no doubt in my mind, there was a very conscious decision made about how Trump should act, how he should present himself in this second debate. And when we talked a few weeks ago after the first one, I did enjoy the first debate, but it was red meat for people who support Trump. It was really not something that was going to persuade maybe it's 8 or 10% of people who are persuadable. Last night was very different. I mean, there was clear preparation that went into that because Trump had answers at the ready for some questions that they had to know were coming, and there was just he was very disciplined in the way he kept hammering at particular points. So yeah, I'm sure that there was a lot of prep work that went into that last night.
Oliver Wiseman, it was a different Donald Trump we saw yesterday. Was it a different Joe Biden?
I actually think both the candidates were a bit better than the first debate. I mean, the Trump Trump's transformation was more night and day because he took such a sort of combative approach the first time. But I thought, I thought Biden was a bit smoother, a bit less kind of flustered than he was in the first debate. I don't think he's a brilliant debater by any means. I think Trump's probably naturally better at these things. And I think your reading on these things depends a bit on how you see the race. So, you know, if you think Biden has a comfortable lead, then he probably did what he needed to do. If you think the race is closer, as I think Chris probably does, then I think you probably think more was gained by Trump last night. And I just think on Trump, I would say, as well as being stylistically better than in the first debate, it's worth pointing out too, I think he, on substance, gave voters more reasons to vote for him in a way that he didn't in the first one. So, you know, in the first debate, you were sort of bombarded with various hang-ups and talking points of his. But last night, you know, on COVID, which is not a good issue for him in general, you did get a clear distinction in approach, for better or for worse, between Biden and Trump. You know, there is a difference in values in terms of reopening versus not on the pandemic. Biden had a very bad unforced error on energy, where he talked about transitioning away from fracking and oil. And so I think on a number of ways, if you imagine a kind of conservative voter, Republican adjacent voter who was a bit off put by Trump, but concerned about the Democratic Party's leftwards drift, I think that kind of person could have watched last night's debate and sort of felt like there was more reason to vote for Donald Trump than there was before the debate started. Now, how much that matters and so on is obviously another question.
Well, one of the things I came away from the debate was I had a little bit more clarity on some of the policies that Joe Biden supported, a little bit more about what Biden care involved, his support for a $15 federal minimum wage, his halfway to citizenship for illegal immigrants. These were all, as it were, fairly clear policies. I came away with no sense of what Donald Trump's policies were. Chris Buskirk, was that deliberate, or would it actually be better if President Trump gave us a little bit more meat?
All you had to do is read the Republican platform, and you know all about Donald Trump's policies. I joke because the Republicans did not issue a platform for this year. No, I think, policies are great for people who are super serious about policy, but elections are won on aesthetics and not on policy. Policy is important for highly political people on either end of the spectrum. And I think the Biden, sort of the deep Biden voters already more or less know that he is towing sort of the standard Democrat line, whether it be on minimum wage or on healthcare or whatever. For Republicans, you know, people know where Donald Trump is on immigration. He's been a little murkier, but I still think not bad on healthcare. Republicans have never seemed to have a good answer on healthcare. And Trump, at least, I think, has done one thing that is very smart on that particular policy point, which is to say that he thinks it's absolutely essential that pre-existing conditions be covered. This is one of these issues where, you know, a lot of the things Trump talks about are very, in a sense, they're almost very narrowly targeted for electoral purposes. So we think about, well, how much difference do some of the things make that, you know, Trump's change in tone or what he talks about pre-existing conditions, you know, is that going to move 10 million votes? No, but it doesn't have to. It might only have to move 50,000 votes in Pennsylvania or 40,000 votes in Michigan or 10,000 in Maricopa County in Arizona, right? It's he has to do some very specific things to win a handful of states to win re-election. And this is where, you know, Biden sort of is operating out of this, you know, a very classic playbook is to talk about the biggest possible policies that you can, whereas it's like Trump is playing a much more tactical game to try and win over the voters in those very particular voters that he needs to get. So for just one final example on this is, you know, all of our polling, and not just ours, but I think almost anybody shows a place where Trump has been weak, where we had expected him to be strong, as an over 65 sort of Republican adjacent voters. And it's because of, you know, most people assume, and I think this is right, that it's because of COVID. So he gave very good answers. I thought they were credible last night about COVID. I thought he was really interesting and pretty compelling when he talks about, like, he's like, look, I had it. We've got very good therapies out there right now. There are trade-offs between, you know, any policy that we pursue here. We got to move on. But remember, like, I had this. I took Regeneron and I got better. This isn't a great situation. You know, for people who want to be persuaded, that, I think, was enough. But that was for a slice of the electorate. It wasn't necessarily meant to persuade everybody. He wasn't going to win San Francisco because of that. But he might win over enough of a portion of the electorate that it makes the difference.
One thing that struck me very forcefully is that it felt a bit as if Joe Biden was the incumbent and Donald Trump was the insurgent challenger. For a lot of the debate, it seemed to me that the 47 years or 38 years that Joe Biden has spent in public life was being tested, and the supposed lack of achievement during that period, as distinct from the 47 months in which Donald Trump has been president. Oliver Wiseman, was this a wise tactic? Is Trump's line, which is in essence... Biden, you had 8 years to do this and you didn't do it. Is that a wise strategy? And I ask the question because does it perhaps blunt the Republican attack that Biden is some dangerous radical, whereas in fact he may just be rather lethargic?
Yeah, I think that I was messaging someone about this during the debate, that I thought Trump's you had eight years, Joe, line is quite a good one. And that general line of attack maybe would have been something they should have been using for longer. You know, I think over the summer, banging on about whether he's senile or why he's in his basement. Like, I think there was, you know, an attack that takes Biden a bit more seriously and is therefore maybe a bit more effective to say, you know, you were in power and what did you do? And I think it also helps Trump with there's that weird, like, jujitsu you need to do as a populist in office where you're the president, but you also are an outsider, and how do you balance that? And that's kind of a good way of Trump doing that. I think, you know, just to flip, you know, one of the really interesting questions about this election, I thought, was crystallized quite neatly. There was a time in the debate last night where Biden was deflecting on some of the stuff to do with his family and his son. And he looked at the camera and said, it's not about my family or your or the president's family. It's about your family at home. And he went on a clearly pre-rehearsed riff that was about COVID and so on. And
a little bit too rehearsed, I felt.
But then Trump said a classic politician's answer. Like, that's what we, you know, that's exactly what you think of a politician. And I think that's kind of what this election is coming down to, is like, is actually what the voters want, a classic politician? Like, maybe people have tasted the Trump kind of offering and think this is too, you know, I've got sort of sensory overload, and actually a classic politician doesn't sound so bad. Or does that outsider message still have the kind of appeal that it evidently had in 2016? If the polls are right, it would suggest people are okay with a bit more politics as usual. But I think that's kind of how I see this race. Like, that's the choice, really.
Chris, what do you feel? Is the Republican line of attack that Joe Biden is old school, washed out, clueless, or is it that actually he is the puppet of radicals?
Yeah, the line has been that's socialism. He's Trotsky in a blue suit or whatever, and it doesn't stick, because I mean it's just not the vibe that Joe Biden gives off. It never has been. I mean, what he is what Donald Trump talked about. I mean, this is a guy who's been in D.C. for a very long time. You know, he's sort of got that classic, you know, used car salesman vibe that politicians often have. He's from a very, very small state. I mean, that's, people don't, I think, necessarily appreciate that Delaware is tiny. And that it sort of contributes to the fact that he has been able to be a senator for as long as he was with, and really accomplish nothing, which is a true criticism of him. He was just there. He was a Democrat vote in the Senate. That was his only job. And he figured out a long time ago that he could use the office to make money for the family. That's been the family business. And this is a much more effective attack on Biden, which is, You don't like the swamp. You don't like Washington. You don't like politicians. You think they're smarmy. You think they're self-dealing. And you've got one right across the stage from me, and I'm the outsider, even though I'm president. That is a much more electorally effective tactic, I think, than saying that this is like, you know, he's a Bolshevik. That just never stuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, your reference to Joe Biden making money inevitably brings us on to the more personal part of the debate, which was the slanging match as to which of the two candidates was more corrupt. Ollie, the attacks on the Biden family and Hunter Biden in particular, the Ukrainian connection, are most Americans following this closely? Do most of them know what is being alluded to in these debates, or are they scratching their head and thinking, when are they going to talk about issues that affect us?
A couple of things. Firstly, I think the way Trump brought the issue up last night was perhaps not as effective as it could have been, because he sort of referenced it, and he referenced the big guy, or whatever the phrase was, which was a line from one of these texts, in passing, in a way which I think a lot of people watching won't have understood what he was talking about. And, you know, he maybe should have laid out the charges in a more straightforward way if he wanted to make hay with that. I also think, you know, frankly, I think Biden has a big structural advantage here, which is that swathes of the US media are not treating this story as seriously as they should be. It's asserted that this is Russian disinformation without there being much evidence of that one way or the other. And I would love for the best reporters in the country to get their teeth into it and tell us more, but there's a political decision that's been made that they won't. So, and then there's the big tech element of it too, which is that, which sort of suppressing the story somewhat. So all of that being said, I think that the I'm not sure how bad the charge is, electorally speaking, in the sense that I think people see that as the kind of low-lying swampy corruption that Chris was talking about that you'd expect from a queer politician in DC. And I think they mostly pin the blame on his son rather than Biden himself. And so, without passing judgment myself on the story, because I think I'm skeptical of this, the idea of this as a October surprise that's going to make a big difference in the way that, say, the Comey letter did 4 years ago.
Chris, is it an October surprise?
You know, I think it's wrong to think of this as sort of an electoral kill shot, which is what I know a lot of Trump supporters want to think this is. Maybe there's something that's breaking on Twitter while we're recording here. I don't know. But I think what it really is that it is part of the case that that the Trump campaign has only just started to make, which is that this is the swamp. This is it's self-dealing. It's corruption in public office. You may think it's big. You may think it's petty corruption. Whatever, but it is what Donald Trump ran against in 16, which is that people get into office and then they sell. They basically sell the office, and they use their family and friends as a means to launder the money, and to live a life that they can't afford to live on their salary as a senator, as a vice president, or whatever. And so, my sense of it is that it is potentially powerful as part of the bigger story, but as a standalone story, I don't think that it wins. I don't think it wins the election.
If I could just, Graham, compare, I think it's worth comparing Biden to Clinton on this, which is part of the reason so much of this was so effective 4 years ago is because American voters had spent several decades, with Hillary Clinton in front and center in American public life. They knew about allegations and scandals and so on in Clinton world. And so they were sort of primed and ready for more evidence of that in a way that I just don't think they are with Biden.
Well, one thing that the mudslinging did achieve was taking center stage in what should have been the foreign policy debate. It is a consequence of that. That segment on foreign policy was almost evaded entirely. who could or should have won on foreign policy, who is seen as being tough? Is Trump seen as being a stooge of Kim in North Korea? Or is Biden seen as being soft on China?
Well, I think that I think that was one of the biggest missed opportunities for Trump actually in the debate, because he didn't talk about Iraq, he didn't talk about Afghanistan, he didn't talk about the foreign policy issues that where he's most in line with the American people, and really I think explains a lot of his electoral appeal. So I sort of felt like that, you know, I don't think Biden completely destroyed him on any of these issues, but I think he just didn't make as much as he could have done there about some of the kind of quote unquote forever wars that he's positioned himself against.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. I mean, this is a place where, you know, it's one of the places where Trump has had the most success, particularly as related to the promises that he made in 15 and 16, which is, you know, he has reduced the scope of American military commitments abroad. He has not started any new wars, which you think, well, okay, is that a thing? Should we be proud of him for that? Well, as it turns out, if you look at American history for the past 50 years, yes, because every other American president has started at least one a war abroad. And Donald Trump is the one who hasn't. You know, there's been a bipartisan addiction to foreign military intervention. And Donald Trump ran against it, and he kept his word on that. I think he should have made more hay on that, because one of my takeaways last night is that... again, this is where Biden kind of is a throwback. You know, he's operating on this sort of 1980s paradigm. And he says, you know, I'm going to confront North Korea. I'm going to confront Russia. I'm going to confront China. I mean, I listen to that and I think, so what? Now we're going to have these sort of bellicose, contentious relationships with that in the Biden administration with these with all these countries. What other ones is he going to add to the list? Because Obama started new conflicts in Yemen and Syria, you know. So I think that America is a place where it would have been beneficial for Trump to remind Americans who retain a sort of a war weariness after decades of these interventions. It would have been a good time for him to remind them that actually he's wound down the wars and that he would continue to do so.
Well, we're winding down the clock now to November the 3rd, where we're in the kind of the zone of the fortnight to go. When was the decisive moment of this campaign? Has there been a decisive moment, Chris?
Yeah, there hasn't been one yet. I mean, it's such an odd campaign. You know, it's all the caveats about 2020 really do apply here. There's a way in which the campaign has just sort of been in slow motion. And, this, you know, I mean, from both sides. I mean, the overall presidential campaign has been a little bit, unreal. It's like people sort of sleepwalking through it. And it seems like it's only picked up in the past month, really. And then and then really last night, I thought in a way was what you would have expected to have happened a month ago. There's been no decisive moment. It's like we're just sort of slouching towards the election.
Ollie, do you feel there's been a decisive moment? If there hasn't, is that because of the effect of COVID? Or is it actually people made their minds up about Donald Trump a long time ago?
I think if Trump, I'm sort of cheating a bit here, but I think if Trump loses, in hindsight, we will look back on him catching COVID as the sort of dramatic climax of this year, at which point, you know, this will be remembered as the pandemic election, and that will be the main reason he lost, partly through bad luck, partly through his own handling of it. And I think that will sort of be the moment that crystallizes the reasons why he lost, if you see what I mean. Obviously, we could fast forward 2 weeks and I could be completely wrong and you can play this on a later podcast and laugh at me. But no, that to me felt like the climax of the thing.
Well, a week is a famously a long time in politics, so a fortnight still gives some hope for Donald Trump to claw back and give us a rather exciting night on November the 3rd. We will look forward to that. Chris Buskirk from American Greatness and Oliver Wiseman from The Critic, thank you both very much for your insights on the US presidential debate.
Thanks.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.